Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things Gumshoe. I'm JM, one of the hosts, and with me as always are Becca and Mark.
Hello.
Howdy.
We have a great show for you this month. We are going to be talking about, we're continuing our discussion on Trail of Cthulhu. Last session we talked about the core book, kind of broke it down, spread it out over a couple of episodes. Today we're going to do a high-level review of two of what I think are the best products in the Trail of Cthulhu line. And that is Hideous Creatures, the bestiary of Call of Cthulhu, and Eternal Lies, which is their campaign. And both of these books clock in at $50 a pop for the physical book, but they are both close to 400 pages. They are chock full of information. But before we get into it, thank you to our new patrons, to Matthias and to Bob. If I've forgotten anyone else, I am sorry. To everyone who's been gifted patronage by Rook, thank you to Rook, as always, for his generosity. And so, yeah, let's get into it. So, Hideous Creatures, it's the bestiary for Trail of Cthulhu. Becca, you had something, I think, in here to share.
I did. This is like one of the first quotes from one of H.P. Lovecraft's books, and it just says, "It is absolutely necessary for the peace and safety of mankind that some of Earth's dark and dead corners and unplumbed depths be left alone, lest sleeping abnormalities wake to resurgent life and blasphemously surviving nightmares squirm and splash out of their black lairs to newer and wider conquests." I found it particularly apt, not only because of this wonderful book, but our scientists today are apparently deciding to go into those unplumbed depths, and they're bringing it all back.
Right? I think earlier last year is when they were bringing up core samples from the area where Raleigh is supposedly at, and we're bringing viruses back to life. They said it was surprisingly easy. That's how mankind ends. So, it contains about 30 monsters. And Becca, do you want to give us a rundown of kind of what it provides for each monster?
It's great. Actually, I was surprised when I cracked this open to see how much is for each monster, because I feel like often when I pop open a bestiary, the monster has maybe half a page, maybe a like sliver of a section. But in this, I mean, each monster has around 10 to 15 pages. And that is awesome because you get so much information. So you get your game statistics, like what they can do, how much health they have, how like crazy they are. You get variations. So if you need to switch it up a little bit because all of your players are super familiar with what star vampires do and you need to throw a little twist in it, they have options for that. They tell you about the mythic echoes, where you might find these stories around the world, how your investigators can learn more about them, scenario seeds, and then a bibliography. So like places where you can, again, find stories and information about all these monsters.
Right. And I think that's like you brought up a really good point. It's different than the, let's call it the D&D model. Mm-hmm. Where we're going to give you 300 monsters in about 300 pages. And this is 400 pages, but we're only giving you 30 monsters. And I mean, Mark and I have talked about this for years, right? The fact that when you start playing, everything is scary in D&D. But by about a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, decades in, oh, it's an orc. I kind of know what role that's supposed to fill. And the same thing is true, right? Lovecraft kind of faded into obscurity for a bit, but Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game, was something that brought it back. And now we're all sort of familiar. We have video games. We have movie references. We have the books are back in print. We have more role-playing games about Cthulhu than you can shake a stick at. And yet, what's great about this game is they sort of break it apart and they say, here is a ton of different things you can have. Let's dig a little bit deeper into this. So the game statistics, they tell you what their abilities are and everything, if they have magic, how difficult they are to hit, how aware and stealthy they are, what weapons, anything special about them, kind of what you would expect out of a bestiary. Then what I love is it also gives you a ton of possible additional abilities. Maybe they were hinted at, but were never fully explained, or maybe they're just ways to mess with the perceptions of the characters. and have them go, well, I know what a deep one can do. Do you really? This one, you know, lashes out with a long tongue. I actually don't know if that one's in there. I'm just pulling an example out of my imagination. And it, but I think it also helps free you as a GM or as a keeper to say, I don't have to run the deep one just as is. I could, I'm trying to think, what game did we play in? Was it Torg? Where I made mutants that had mouths in their bellies? Oh no, it was Glorantha. It was the brute.
Yeah.
And yeah. Everyone's like, okay, brew or beastman? What do you mean their stomach opens with and is a fang-filled maw? Mm-mm. That's what causes players to react like Becca does.
Mm-mm. No, no.
I like that it makes it, it allows you to make the mythos your own in your campaign.
Yes.
And instead of just coming up, because anybody can do that in a game, you can take your regular 5th edition D&D and go, you know what? Orcs are going to be psychic. I like that they give you kind of canonical ideas, like you said, might have been in one story from not Lovecraft, but another author later on that hinted at something. So it kind of goes with the theme. I like Migos, and you can go from buzzing hypnosis to mind probe to other things that aren't in the standard set, which is just great because it allows you to make it your own.
Yeah, I agree. And in the chat, it does keep players guessing about what they're facing. And I think this goes back to what I consider kind of a seminal quote from H.P. Lovecraft, right? The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is the fear of the unknown. Orcs are scary until you face them 100 times. Then they're not. Even Shuggoths, they're scary until they're not, because you're like, oh, okay, I've read To the Mountains of Madness. I've read, you know, I've played in Call of Cthulhu. And so what, and Kenneth Haidt wrote the majority of it, I think. And then we have additional text by Garth Ryder Heinrichan, who we've interviewed on the show, Becky Anison, Helen Gould, and Ruth Tillman. And Ruth Tillman did a bunch of Cthulhu icons for 13th Age back in the day, which were just spectacular. But they do that. They take what is known and suddenly introduce an element of uncertainty. When we get into our Knights Black Agents, we're going to find the same thing. It's a vampire. But what kind of vampire did the GM design? So the mythic echoes are really cool. That's probably my favorite part of the book, where they say, here is a bat thing. We've given you all of its Cthulian stats. Here is what it could be based off local myths and legends from throughout the world. Maybe you're in Greece, and instead of a bat thing as it is in normal Cthulhu, it is a Minyades. The daughters of Minyas refused to take part in a bacchanalia and were turned into creatures. I mean, right, Lovecraft was an atheist humanist, and so he didn't necessarily believe in the supernatural. The closest we get, I think, is in The Witch House, where you have witches, but even then, it's really peeling the layers of superstition back and revealing the cold, uncaring universe is kind of Lovecraft's jam. So the fact that they put all of these mythic resonances or mythic echoes makes the most sense, because it's like, well, what people thought were ulamas or popobawa in Tanzania, those are actually bat things. They just didn't, you know, it's their own legends kind of handed down and their own myths that were sort of changed. Now, Mark, Becca mentioned the investigative clues that come with each monster. Can you dig into those a little bit for us and tell us how a GM could use those? Like what does it give? What do they do? How would you use them?
Like you said, they're clues. And what I like is not just a clue. They list your investigative abilities and give you clues for that. Again, since I like the Migo and I'm on that. Clues. Accounting. The pay stub we found on the silent watcher comes from a mining company that ceased operations in 1874, but its bank account apparently still exists. And if you get into it and start investigating Migos, that's one of the things they do, is they get into mining, maybe. And so it ties it into the investigative abilities, instead of you having to come up with, okay, I've got this accountant who's out there searching for something, or you happen to have, say he's a police person that took accounting, you know, he was more of the, you know, into that aspect of crime fighting. Here's an example of something they can find. I would even use it, like you talk about the mythic echoes. I would tie it even into the folklore and maybe some of these stuff you find. And actually, you can also throw in some red herrings. Just give them some info, and it doesn't have to be, you could say, I would say true, because we kind of skipped over the variations. We have possibles, but variations get into where the, like Migo, where they come from, who's against them, and they specifically say intentionally self-contradictory. Well, no, Migo come from here. Well, no, this mythos says they're from here, or they worship Hastur. Or no, no, wait, they're enemies of Hastur. It's just different things that you can throw out there. So when you give them the clues, because I can tell you, this is an investigative game. If you give them clues 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, end story, it will get boring. You need to give them clues 1, 2, A, X, alpha, beta, and give them different things, and they need to figure out what's true, what's not. And mm-hmm. these give you these excellent possibilities and variations, mythic echoes of, well, wait a minute, my grandfather emigrated from Greece, and he said that this is the bat thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you throw all that out there, let it mix it up and make it your own. Excellent stuff.
Yeah, and I agree. Completely excellent stuff. And we're not just talking like one or two investigative abilities.
No, they list everyone.
They list everyone. Yeah.
Everyone. That's why it's so many pages for 30 monsters. There's this page after page just for the one. Mind-boggling how they put this together. They really made it easy for the lore master to go, hey, here you go. You don't really have to make up. You can, but it gives you really good seeds to germinate and make it your own and take off with it.
Yeah.
Really good.
I also love the fact that there's handouts for every monster. So if you get the PDF, I mean, don't cut pages out of your book unless you want to. I can't tell you what to do with your book, but I would cry.
You cut one up and you have one to use.
Yeah. I mean, I did that with the Horror on the Orient Express because I was like, I have a handout book. I'm supposed to cut them all out, but I feel bad about that. So I'm going to buy another copy. So, but if you get the print book from Pellgrane, you also get the PDF. Actually, I think Pellgrane is part of the Bits and Mortar program. So if you buy a physical copy at your friendly local game store, you can ask them to sign up for Bits and Mortar, and they can send you a free copy of the PDF for any of the Pellgrane products that you purchase. Favorite monsters. Let's start with Becca, because she was very coy about what her favorite monster was before the show. And so I'm going to put her on the spot.
Oh, I was, because I was like, well, I can't tell you what my favorite monsters are if I'm going to use them in my game in June. So, you know, you guys just have to guess. And then Mark was like, oh, you like the Wendigo. I was like, well, yeah, I do. I mean, let's be honest. All the monsters are great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like the Wendigo, I feel like the Wendigo is just such a classic North American monster. A lot of times I feel like a bunch of the monsters that we see have such mythic roots from the old country. Wherever that is. But this one, it has like the mythic echoes from New York and Quebec and French Canada, because you have the Loup Garou or even Grendel from Denmark and Britain. It's just a fun monster, especially if you have the tale or belief kind of sewn into your game that those who die insane in the north become a Wendigo, or any human who then commits an act of cannibalism and eats other humans eventually become a Wendigo. And so then there's that idea of, maybe I know that person. Maybe that's Uncle Jerry who disappeared mm-hmm. 25 years ago. So I think it's a fun one that you can get really personal with and to make it terrifying.
I like that. Mark, you mentioned the Migo. Why don't you go?
Migo?
I've been waiting you to make go. That joke since I saw it go into the outline.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, the Migo. I don't know if you mentioned it. At the start of every monster, there's a quote. Mm-hmm. Migo. They were pinkish things about 5 feet long with crustaceous bodies bearing vast pairs of dorsal fins or membranous wings and several sets of articulated limbs, and with a sort of convoluted epsiloid covered with multitudes of very short antennae where a head would ordinarily be. They sometimes walked on all their legs and sometimes on the hindmost pair only, using the others to convey large objects of indeterminate nature. H.P. Lovecraft, The Whisperer in Darkness. So yeah, I like it. It's I can't really explain why. I think it's kind of cool to have a flying lobster. That's how I picture them. And again, like we said, it has their abilities, what they could possibly do. I like that they're flying lobsters who like to surgically remove your brains and put them in a container and keep them alive and use them. Just, they even have, so you're a brain in a cylinder. You could wake up and you're a brain in a cylinder, and it gives you stability tests, and you have your academic and technical abilities remain the same, but you can't do physical things. So you could be a PC brain in a cylinder, I guess, if the party lugs you around because you're unfortunate enough to get surgery with their little magic wands. Reminds me of Mars Attacks when they had the brain in the jar,
and they attached like some lady's head to was it Paris Hilton's head to her little chihuahua?
No, it was what's her name? Sex in the City.
Oh, Sarah Jessica Parker. Yeah, that's who it was.
Put her on a little dog, and she was there talking to Pierce Brosnan's, whose head was in the globe. Yeah, it's just they're definitely out there, and they have reasons of why they're here. They're not the great old ones or like that. They're just, alien species from another planet that happened to be here. And they might be with the Elder Gods. They might be against them. It depends on your campaign and what you want to do with them. I just think they're really neat monsters, as it were. Not too overpowering so you can beat them, but they're definitely... And I like it. If you see your party member... have their brain removed, you still lose a point of stability even if you make your save. It's just, nope, you're losing a point of stability when they remove Jam's brain. Like, done. Then it's your mission to go recover that cylinder and tote him around. He's still alive.
Yeah.
How you communicate with them, unless they've got those little devices set up to it, but...
So, not Trail of Cthulhu-based, Mark, but if you want more Mego goodness... A Time to Harvest just came out for Call of Cthulhu, and the Mego are the major threat in the Vermont Hills, with a ton of great art about like all of the different castes of Mego that really only apply to that adventure, but you can mine it for other things.
Oh, sure.
And then the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society did Whisper in the Dark, Whisper in the Darkness as a... Yeah. 1930s like Frankenstein sort of like feel, so black and white. They added a little bit at the end because like many of Lovecraft stories just end when the protagonist goes crazy, so they like give you like a resolution. It's good. I enjoyed it, and it's got Mego in it, and it's got the brain cases, and the brain cases are really cool in there.
Yep Yeah, they're just, and that would be something like, if you go again, you go looking for Uncle Jeremy who disappeared, and you come across this stasis room, and you find, Abby Normal and Uncle Jeremy, and they have rules where they can hook up devices to communicate with these, and think of the stability lost there when you discover that your uncle's now just a brain in a canister.
I love that you brought up Young Frankenstein in the middle of that, Mark. Like, well done.
Good stuff.
I mean, my favorite mythos monster isn't a Lovecraft monster. It's a Frank Long monster, the Hound of Tyndalos, these creatures that travel through time, and they don't exist in the curves of the world. They only exist in the angles of the world. So they come out of any place where two planes join. And the story is great, the Hounds of Tyndalos. I love these creatures because... they are a sword of Damocles that hangs over the heads of people who have the audacity to try and look through time. And I love this line here. I mean, they give you a number of examples of, depending on where you're in the world, you could mistake them, their attacks, for other things. Sharks, wolverines, honey badgers, I added that one in there. Cobras, tigers, that sort of thing. But they stalk the angles of time for those who witness them. And then they just keep hunting you down. I feel like they did a lot with the variations on the hound abilities, the possible abilities, the different variations, and the mythic echoes are just delightful. Black Shuck of England, Cerberus of Greek, Inugami of Japan, Shah of Egypt, these very like canine-like connections. I really want to run a game in the Moors, and basically have it be a Hound of Tyndalos and not a giant hound. I think that would be just a spectacular game.
And reading through that, it makes you wonder, there's another author who had this epic, 13 series novel that had these hounds that chased you that weren't, they're like out of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, he did some reading.
Yeah. The Hounds of Light and Dark and Shadow in the Malazan series.
No, I was thinking of Wheel of Time.
Oh yeah, the Wheel of Time too. Sorry, I went Malazan, but you have a
never good... go full Malazan.
Never go full. I live full Malazan. It's my line, and I'm sticking to it. All right, so I know we've kind of covered this, but to kind of wrap this up, how would you rate this book in terms as first a bestiary and second as a inspirational tool for keepers who are running Trail of Cthulhu?
I think it's great. If you haven't heard from our enthusiasm, I think we like it. It has lots of varied lore. It's not just here's a list of the monsters, here's what you throw at your people. Here's Amigo. Here's 14 variations you can throw in there. It's like, what? Here's the mythic. Here's some scenario seeds. Here's this so much that you can throw out there. It's not just, a few. Plus, the main book has some in the bestiary section, if I remember right. You have this one. It's just, they're great. They're great. I like it. I think it's definitely worth it if you don't have the $50 for a hardcover, and for me it's, I have a lot of PDFs just because, as you can see, my bookshelves are full. So I have a lot of PDFs just because I don't have the physical room. If I had a physical book for all the PDFs I have, I'd need a separate house. So I get a lot of PDFs just because of the space. I just don't have the room for all the I'd like to buy.
I really appreciate all the work the authors have done in kind of doing the legwork for the GM. In finding the mythic echoes, in giving you all the variations, in the descriptions and the investigations. There's like, they did so much of the legwork, and it helps to see how they recommend doing it so that when you come up with your own creature, you know what you need to prepare for your own gumshoe. It sets you up ready to go. And then when you're ready to take the step to do your own, you know what you're going to do. So I think it's great. I'm interested in probably getting a physical copy just because that's my preference. But having even the PDF so you can print off the handouts is a great tool to have.
Yeah. I know when we tend to review Pelgrane products, we're all like, woo, we love Pelgrane products. And we do. I mean, that's one of the we wouldn't be doing a show about Trail of Cthulhu and Gumshoe and Five Seasons of 13th Age if we weren't going into it very excited and inspired by it. You know, when you look at the number on the back, 30 monsters, you're like, is that worth $50? Right? Mm-hmm. Because again, $50 will get you the fifth edition monster manual, and that's hundreds of monsters. But again, this thing is probably 1.5 times the size of the current monster manual. And while there's only 30 monsters, each monster is so beefy and so rich. And also, as a GM, I could take this book and run a session of Trail of Cthulhu with very little prep. Pick a monster, look at the clues, figure out where you're going to place the first ones, and start the scenario with someone dead.
Right.
And I've got a Trail of Cthulhu scenario basically instantly. As we've said before, it's a $50 hardcover, $25 PDF. You can get the hardcover from and PDF bundled together from Pelgrane. We'll put links in the show notes for getting it through Amazon and drive-through and through Pelgrane as well. And again, here's the thing. Companies sell books to stay in business. And so if you like Trail of Cthulhu and you don't have this book, buying this book kind of helps the next book come off the line.
Well, that brings us to the end of our sixth episode this season, where we talked about Hideous Creatures, the bestiary for Trail of Cthulhu. We'll be back in 2 weeks, and we're going to review the Eternal Lies campaign for Trail of Cthulhu.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
You've been listening to the Iconic Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. Also, check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and more information about the show. Thanks for listening.